Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Blake Zanti on the show. Blake is the executive director of the Kenneth L. Matty Institute and has worked as a district representative to former Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, as well as a press secretary for Senator Andreas Borges and operated a public affairs consultancy. We dig into public policy, education, political persuasion, Division I sports, Meanette's Pizza, and a lot more. Please enjoy our conversation. Quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best. Blake, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Ooh, I love to go to, it depends what sort of food I'm trying to get. But I love to go to Max's Bistro. That's probably my favorite dinner spot where my wife and I like to go. If I'm just looking for something casual, you can't really go wrong. There's so many different taco trucks and places to go in Fresno. I can't pick a favorite. Yeah.
What's your order at Max's?
Ooh, I love to get the filet. I love to get I'll get a salad or a soup with it as well on the side. You got to get the sweet potato fries. Those are always really good. And always get a nice glass of wine with that too. It makes it a good meal.
I don't know if you saw this hilarious article that came out recently about how different political parties eat at restaurants. And there was a great article about Capitol Grill, which is this famous restaurant in DC. And in DC, Republicans outspend Democrats at steakhouses 13-1.
I believe that. Definitely.
Why do you believe that?
I just think if you walk into any steakhouse in DC, you'll definitely see a lot of politicians, both sides, but you'll definitely see a lot of Republican politicians. I don't know what it is.
Love their red meat.
They just love their red meat. And maybe there's some irony in that too. That's funny.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about a bunch of different things today. I want to start with background and education questions to understand a little bit more about you. And I want to start by asking you a broad question. Do you think that interning in a legislature is going to give you more or less trust in government processes?
I think more trust. I think that you really get an inside lens into sort of the legislative process and policymaking. And it's a process that's very confusing. And a lot of folks don't understand, not because that they don't have the ability to. I think it's just something when people are busy with their everyday lives, they're taking kids to school, they're going to work, they're trying to buy groceries. People sometimes don't have what I like to say is that they don't have the luxury of trying to peruse through the complex legislative process and figure out, okay, where is this bill in committee and what's going on? And that's why we elect representatives to try and do that work on our behalf. And then we can either choose to elect them or not reelect them. But I think the internship process, and that's something that the Matty Institute is critically involved in, is really an inside window to give folks that experience. And some of our interns don't choose to not go on into politics or in that career field, but they still learn those valuable lessons and then take those forward in their, professional and personal life.
Okay. When students declare a major in political science, do you think they're fully grasp the kind of work that they're going to be doing in their coursework?
A lot of the political science coursework, I will say, and this is my own personal experience. So if there are other political science folks listening, maybe they had a different experience, but I would say it's very theoretical in the beginning. It's a lot of theoretical framework, a lot of philosophy. And so you don't really gain that practical experience until maybe later in your major when you're a junior or senior, internship opportunities arise and come about. And I think that's where people really, if they want to go into the legislature, or they want to work in political campaigns, that's where they gain really the nuts and bolts of how things work. Certainly, political science education is very useful, teaches you how to critically think and examine and analyze. But I think if you want to learn, what does it mean to work on a bill or how do you navigate through the political process? That's, you really gain that just like any career field through an internship.
And that kind of segued to my next question. Do you feel like there was sufficient time spent on comparative political science when you were studying as an undergrad? And do you think that should be increased or do you think we should focus on our own system more in kind of the coursework?
Yeah, there are comparative courses in the curriculum, at least from my own background, I would say. At Fresno State, there are a couple of different international, you take international politics, you take comparative politics, to try to examine the different systems of government, how they work, how they may not work as well. And so I thought that was really important. I would say it's not, it is something that I would say is a big part of the curriculum. And a lot of you can either choose to continue studying that, or you may just only take a couple classes on it. But I think it's my personal belief is we really need to do a better job of our own civic education here in the US. And that's something that really the Maddie Institute sort of strives to do is promote that work. But yeah, I think we could do a much better job doing civic education here in the US.
Given your work that you do now and then your experience working with politicians, do you think there's a certain kind of course that should be added to a traditional political science degree that would enhance a person's ability to work in the political world? Or is there something that either maybe needs more emphasis or something that needs to be added?
There are a lot of different electives that you can take, and sometimes you just simply don't have the capacity to add another course that you might find useful. Like I said, those upper division courses typically are a little bit more specialized. I took a water politics course. You can take a campaign and elections course. I think you can take courses on the bureaucracy and state and local politics. So I think that there's a pretty good diversification, at least from my own degree experience, where you can sample a lot of the different fields and options that you can enter into with a political science degree. Because Jordan, the options are limitless. People think, oh, political science. I had a number of folks tell me and family members say, oh, you're really limiting yourself with a political science degree. But you can go work in a state or federal agency. You can go work at City Hall. You can go work at the county. You can work for a campaign, an elected official. You can work in a nonprofit. You can go into the legal field. A lot of people choose to pursue a law degree. So there are a lot of different options from political science, and those are just a few. So I guess my short answer is no. I don't think there's anything specific I would add. Maybe I would just emphasize maybe offering more course credit to gain those practical sort of pre-career experiences, like interning or being a fellow in an agency, are really important.
You just segued perfectly into my next question. I read this past week this somewhat, I would say, absurd article in the New York Times. It was written by someone that goes to an Ivy League school, so of course it's relevant to all of us. And one of the things that this student describes is that careerism is destroying colleges, that students are increasingly focused on what comes next. And so in that mindset, the actual coursework and spending the time exploring ideas is perceived as a waste of time in some capacity, and that it's much more important to focus on grad school or getting into the right firm after you graduate. Do you agree with that general take, or do you think it's off in some ways?
I think I haven't read the article, but I think that there's a balance. Certainly, I think this idea that it's bad to be thinking about your next steps in your career while you're a college student is very impractical. I think that's something that's how our economy works. That's how, where our system really works. And I think it's important to inspire folks to want to achieve and do better and build a successful career, have a successful life. But that doesn't mean it's mutually exclusive that you can't continue exploring ideas and continue learning throughout that career. I think I'm a huge fan of lifelong learning, reading, studying. I just completed my master's degree when I was in my career working full time. So I wouldn't say it's being this idea of focusing on your career is ex mutually exclusive with this idea of wanting to explore new ideas and build on your knowledge.
Yeah, I think it's incredible some of the opportunities you can get. I went to a state school as well, and one of the opportunities I had was to work for the Fulbright Commission when I was an undergrad. And so I had a kind of a group of 12 graduate students from Germany that I managed their trip to San Francisco, and it was so much fun. And I learned and applied a lot of the things that, studying German history. And so I was able to see applications of those, and I think that is so underrated as an experience for college students to connect in some way to what comes after. So, yeah, I completely agree with you. Next question, and kind of on a similar note, and we often hear about politics on college campuses today. There's a lot of discourse around that. And a lot of the campuses that are being discussed are far away from here and much more elite schools. How would you describe the politics of your typical student at Fresno State? What's your kind of analysis of like how Fresno State fits into that larger discussion?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've seen some recent examples of this where I think it's something unique to the San Joaquin Valley, where I think we live in a small, a relatively small community compared to other larger urban areas or some of these larger Ivy League schools. And so I think there's this natural sort of push that folks understand. And it's something that was really integral to the Maddie Institute, really integral. You see a lot of our politicians. Yes, we do have some lightning rods. I think this desire to work together and come together. And it's okay to disagree without being disagreeable. And I think Fresno State, if you look at some of the recent examples that have gone on nationally, hasn't occurred at Fresno State, or to my knowledge, any of the Valley campuses. They haven't really had that same level of strife and conflict because I think that people are able to express their views peacefully, but still getting their point across without trying to cause conflict. And so I think that's important. I think the Valley can be a model for how to have civil discourse on issues of local, state, national importance. And so that, I guess, to bring it back to your original question, what's the typical politics of a student at Fresno State? I would say it's these students want to be civically engaged. Younger people are paying more attention to our elections and politics than previously. That could be because now there's more access to information. That could be because now I think that there are more efforts to motivate young people to vote. Obviously, younger people can become automatically registered to vote when they get a driver's license through the DMV. So there's a lot of these systems in place that I think spur earlier civic engagement. There was also a recent study that PPIC conducted on the young politi on the views of young Californians. And that sort of showed that younger Californians don't like the divisiveness of older generations. They're tired of this rhetoric that we're seeing play out on the national level. Doesn't matter how conservative they are, doesn't matter how liberal they are. Really, the general consensus is that young people just want solutions. And so I would say that really is embodies what I would say a Fresno State student has.
Okay, this next question is targeted towards your recent master's degree, your master's in public administration, correct?
Yes, correct.
I'm curious your perspective, and this is a discussion that was opened with, I don't know if it's officially published, this kind of Project 2025, where it's looking at civil service and asking how to think about it politically. And it seems, was curious for you, using your crystal ball, but also what you've been studying recently, what's the prognosis for you in terms of civil service and where do you see it going? Do you think it's going to become a more politicized institution where you have some of these lifetime civil servants moving out for more political appointees? Or do you think that will always be this static thing that's part of our government where you have these seemingly nonpartisan civil servants operating a lot of the federal bureaucracy?
Yeah, that's a great question. This is something certainly not new to US politics. We have a history. You go back to the very early days of the US and the spoils system and political appointees being appointed to positions in government in the United States by the president or whoever else. It's something that the US has constantly had to reform, not only over really over the last century and a little bit more than that. We've seen this before. I think this notion of we need to have people with the same political views appointed, or I should say that this notion that there's this push to appoint politically motivated heads of bureaucracy in bureaucratic positions is, I would say, is dangerous. I think we should probably err on the side of protecting our nonpartisan bureaucratic system and appointments, I should say, without making them overly political. There's always going to be politics in the bureaucracy. It's just the nature. There are factors to mitigate against that. But if you study some of the recent literature, it's difficult to completely separate this political administration dichotomy that exists. It does exist. That being said, though, I think effective public managers are not focused on the politics of the day. They're focused on trying to do what's in the interest of the people and what's in the interest of their overall political community. And I say political community as not in a political context, but really the constituency, the people in the United States. And so I think that's where it's very dangerous to venture out and try to propose where on either side of the aisle that we're going to have political appointees in our civil service system. I think it should be a merit-based system where, people who want to do good work, who have the qualifications, are able to get there and be in those positions.
Okay. I have a few questions about your journey to the Maddie Institute. I want to start with a few of your positions before that. So I read an article that you were, quote, the eyes and ears for Kevin McCarthy in Fresno. That was the term that they used in the article. How was McCarthy's approach different in Fresno relative to his home district of Bakersfield? How did you think about those areas conceptually representing him?
Yeah, first of all, I think that was definitely a little overblown in terms of that attribution. But I think really I got brought onto a staff to help with develop the Fresno area and develop relationships in the Fresno area when redistricting occurred. Redistricting happened. Fresno, Kevin McCarthy had never really represented Fresno. And so the congressman and his team were looking for someone who was rooted in the community that could help bridge that gap because Bakersfield and Fresno, while they have similarities, are very different places. And so I think looking at that, and I'm sorry, what was your original question?
I was curious about how he conceptualized his work in Bakersfield relative to his work in Fresno, and what, because I think that illustrates some of the differences between the community, both demographically, but also in mindset.
I think the congressman's hometown, it was Bakersfield. And so he was born and raised there. He knew the community a lot better, I would say, in Bakersfield. But in terms of his work district wide, we had the same services, same constituent services. He felt it was very important to have that same level of representation in the north part of the district, even though it was 2 hours away, than that he did in Bakersfield. And so that's why we worked really hard to open an office in Fresno County, which I helped spearhead that effort, running his Clovis district office. And so it was really important to him, even though the sort of the center of gravity was Bakersfield. And I think he acknowledged that, but that there was this even representation throughout the entire district. And it's, if you look at a map, it's a vast district. It includes parts of Kings County, Tulare County, Fresno County, and then of course, Kern County, and includes a lot of rural parts of those counties where it can take several hours to get up to the mountains, to foothills. So I spent a lot of time on the road driving, but that was really his focus, was constituents first, representation. And I think it served him very well. If you look at historically all of his elections that he's had, yes, people will say, oh, he's in a safe district, but he won by a pretty overwhelming percentage each time he was up for re-election. So I think that speaks a lot to his real focus on his district first.
Okay. I want to ask a legacy question. We're all familiar with the loss of the speakership and the downfall and then how that's been portrayed in the media. I'm curious about your perspective. Like, how do you think that particular conflict and that outcome will affect his legacy and like the history of the Republican Party and how they look at this particular period?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm certainly biased because he is a former boss, but I would say a lot of the conflict animosity rose out of the budget deal that was enacted because the government needed to be funded. And so last September, there was a lot of conflict arising from that. There was a more conservative wing of the Republican Party who wanted to include certain initiatives. I think maybe some would say that to become Speaker, Congressman McCarthy negotiated away some of his authority as Speaker, maybe that past speakers have chosen to hold on to. And I think that speaks a lot to him. And people, I think, would argue, oh, he was just so desperate to get power. I don't think that's the case, having worked very closely with him. He's a very much consensus-driven person that wants to try to get to yes. And so I think that's where that grew out of. Same thing with the budget bill. He's really focused on getting yes, even if it meant working with the Democrats to do what was right. And so I hope that history looks favorably upon that, because we need more of that consensus-driven policymaking where people are working across the aisle to get to a solution. And it's interesting, this isn't the first instance where a Republican or a Democrat in leadership has been punished by their party for compromising with the other side. I mean, we see this all throughout history at all levels of government. But I think it's just a reminder that in our system of government, you do get punished sometimes for working with the other side of the aisle. And so this was a clear example of that.
My next question is related to some work you did with the Planning Commission. If you had to identify two or three skills that would make someone a more effective planning commissioner, what do you think those would be?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think doing your research and your homework on the issues is really important. If there are folks listening who are interested in being on the Planning Commission, it's definitely a lot of reading, a lot of intensive work. Occasionally, I'll drive out to some of the sites. If there's a big item up on the agenda, just to go look at it, just to see what it looks like. What property, what area are we discussing here? And so I think that's really important. My approach in the commission is I really try to listen a lot more than I speak. Some other members contribute more input. I really like to hear out both sides. And then usually at the end, if I feel strongly about it, I'll vocalize and I'll give my opinion. But I think it's important to listen. It's just important to listen as well. That's our job on the Planning Commission. We have a certain set of criteria that we need to make decisions on based off of different findings. The other part of the process is the people part, right? People who come, they voice their opinion, they say whether they're for or against something. And so I think it's important for us as commissioners to listen to those people as they're coming forward.
All right. We're going to jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you, and you tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why. Feel
Okay,
free to
great.
pass on any of these. So the first one is Me and Ed's Pizza.
Ooh, I actually really like Me and Ed's. I think underrated, I would say.
Okay,
Might
why?
be controversial opinion. I think it's a hometown pizza joint. Maybe it's just pride. I wouldn't call it the best pizza, but I would say it's Fresno. It's part of Fresno's pizza. You gotta like Me and Ed's if you live in Fresno.
Okay.
Controversial opinion. I'll probably get crucified for it after
Yeah.
this.
We've had such varied answers to that question. I think I've asked almost 140 people by this point.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty evenly split. So it's not a consensus pizza place by any means. Next
Yeah.
one, the importance of presidential debates. We've had a presidential and a vice presidential debate. I watched the one on Tuesday. That one was actually probably more interesting for you in terms of a policy debate. I got more into the weeds than the presidential debate. But do you think those debates are over underrated in their importance?
I think they're underrated. I think the American people need to see both candidates discussing issues. I think it's important for people to see both sides coming together to debate issues. And even if it's contentious at times, that dialogue to the fabric of our, civic society is critical. And so when that dialogue stops or it's cut out, it was shocking to know that the vice president and former President Trump had not met up until that first debate. I was surprised to learn that. I don't know if other folks know that, but I
Yeah, I
was
thought
just
it was a
like,
little awkward
wow,
when she introduced herself.
it was a little
Then
awkward.
I read
Yeah.
after that they had never met before, and that kind of blew my mind. In some ways it makes sense, but in other ways not.
Yeah, but I, yeah, exactly. But I think it's important to have
Yeah.
those debates.
Okay, next one. This is a concept, a famous concept by Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein. The concept of the nudge, government nudging people to make right choices. Do you think that's over or underrated from a kind of policy perspective?
I would say that's an interesting one. So basically what you're asking is, should government nudge people? And
Yeah.
I would say it's overrated. I think I don't know. You can be a cynic and believe that people are not going to make the right choice. But I do think we need to have some trust in people to be able to make decisions for themselves.
Okay. Next one, a place close to where you work, Doghouse, over or underrated.
Oh boy, this is going to be controversial, but I think I am only steps from Doghouse Grill. I smell it in the morning at 9 o'clock in the morning. I've wavered a little bit. I think maybe a little overrated, just slightly, just because I'm so close, but I'll come back around and
Yeah,
be
they
back at
made some
Doghouse.
changes to some of their staple items that I wasn't pleased with.
Yeah.
I was the guy that would go to the counter and ask for buckets of sauce. And from an economic standpoint and an accounting standpoint, I understand
Right.
why they made the sauce container smaller and why they limit the amount that they distribute. I get that. But also, I feel like the tri-tip used to be cut differently. There's just some changes that I've noticed that I've not been as pleased with. But yeah, I won't ever turn down a basket of fries for sure.
Exactly. I'm in the same boat as you.
All right. Okay. Next one. Northern Ireland as a travel destination.
Oh, definitely underrated. I loved going to Northern Ireland.
What
What
were
an
some of the
incredible
highlights for you?
place. Oh my gosh. I'd say the people, number one, are so friendly. Everyone loves the US. I think everyone I met loves the US. They're so welcoming, so friendly, very underrated. And people will think this is controversial, but I thought the food was actually really good. The Irish people have found a way to make potatoes taste different 100 different ways, and a lot of them are very good. I was very impressed. And so I think some of the things that I got to do on that trip were just amazing, but I loved seeing the Giant's Causeway. That was just such a cool place to go see.
I've never been to Ireland. I've been to other parts of Europe. I've never been to Ireland, and it's high up on my list as some of that genetic material runs through my body. I know I need to make the pilgrimage and sit in a pub and be cranky or something. All right,
Yep.
next one, C-SPAN.
I would say definitely underrated, but I'm
More
a
people should
political
watch
nerd.
sell C-SPAN, please.
I think when I worked for Speaker McCarthy, I probably watched more C-SPAN than I ever, probably for the rest of my life. It was a lot of C-SPAN.
Let's
But
say
I, you
I
know,
made you the CEO of C-SPAN. What would you do from a marketing standpoint to get more people to
oh
watch
my
it? Because
gosh.
C-SPAN is it's in the same category as Ambien. It's something that typically people use to go to sleep. How would you market it differently, maybe?
I would say, oh boy, it's certainly been an interesting Congress this year, but I would say just the worst part is like controversy sells. So I guess if I was the CEO of C-SPAN, even though this I personally disagree with this philosophy, I would probably just try to sell all the crazy shenanigans going on the House floor and try to market that, maybe do some little clips on X or Instagram, do some reels
There
to
you
get people
go. That's
engaged.
what
Yeah.
C-SPAN needs. We need some reels or
Yeah.
maybe karaoke on the House floor or something. I think there's lots of
Yeah.
that
We
would
could
be a
do, yeah,
perfectly American thing. All
we could
right.
maybe do some debates. Yeah. See who wins. Yeah.
Okay, this is an interesting one, and it's not really within the category of over versus underrated, but I was curious your perspective. The concept of a protest vote. I listened to George Will, who's a real famous conservative columnist and writer and thinker, and he was defending this idea that non-voting is actually a vote against options, if you will. And he actually thought it was just as virtuous an act as like voting for a candidate, not voting for a candidate to express your dissatisfaction with the slate. Do you agree with his take, or do you think that whoever's on the slate, part of your civic duty is to vote?
I would say I think people have the freedom to make whatever choice they want to make. If they, so I guess in that sense, I guess I would be on board with the protest vote. If people didn't want to vote for a candidate, they can leave it blank. Maybe they don't agree with either candidate. But what I would qualify that with is if there are other things on your ballot, don't leave your whole ballot blank. Make sure you're voting in the other races, the other elections as well. I think some concern is that people don't like either of the presidential candidates. They'll turn in a ballot. They won't vote. I think that's wrong. I think you should definitely still do the research on the other issues that are affecting your community, your state. But if I would say, in the interest of American democracy and freedom, if you don't want to vote for a candidate, I guess you have that choice.
Okay, two more in this
Yeah.
section. California's proposition system. Do you think that's over or underrated in terms of its ability to improve how governments run?
Certainly, it's become way more influential. It has become so influential in California politics. So I guess I would say underrated as well, just because I think people don't realize how much the legislature sometimes will, you know, punt decisions to the ballot process, or how citizens can really garner the support to be able to get something on the ballot, or other interest groups as well. Typically, we see a lot of special interest groups get what they want on the ballot, maybe an issue that the legislature won't fix, or the political willpower to address it just simply doesn't exist. So I would say underrated.
Okay, last one. The genre of political memoirs. Some of them can be really mind-numbing. I've read a few
Oh,
good ones, but it feels like those are few and far between.
I would say overrated. I'm going to end that one on overrated. There are a lot of political memoirs out there. I
Have
have
you
a
read a
bunch.
good one? Have you read one that you've enjoyed? I struggle to, I definitely, it was interesting. Obama is such a good writer that I've enjoyed his, I guess, what they're considering part one.
Yeah.
But at times, it, I mean, it's also a bit of a sales pitch. And I struggle with the genre myself.
Yeah, it's tough. I think when you work in this space, you're just, okay. I think Obama's was good. I think John Boehner, I really enjoyed his. That might just be a personal bias because I like John Boehner. Yeah. But overrated.
All right, let's jump to some policy questions before we go there, Maddie and Fresno State. All right. Sorry, my outline refreshed here. I will cut this out. And now Siri's talking to me. Shut up. I hate these. I need to take this watch off. Do you ever find that you're in the middle of talking? That happened to me. I was doing a talk at the Fresno Philharmonic after our concert last weekend, and I lifted the microphone up to my face and said something, and then Siri responded back into the microphone for my Apple Watch. So I am never wearing an Apple Watch on a stage
Oh
ever
my
again, I don't
gosh.
think. Okay. So here's we're going to pivot to the policy section. What percentage of American voters consider policy positions important when they're thinking about candidates? What do you think? It's 50%? Do you think it's 25%?
Oh my gosh. I feel like I'm very unprepared for this question. I don't know what the, if there is a percentage that, I don't have a percentage off the top of my
Yeah,
head,
I
but
guess I'm getting you
I would,
to like to discuss.
is
Do
this
you
just like a
think?
guesstimate, like
Now,
whatever I
let me
think?
rephrase the question because I phrased it poorly. How
Okay.
important do you think policy considerations are for the average voter?
I would say they're somewhat important. I think a lot of voters, we see a lot of single issue voters, and they'll vote based off of a single issue that they feel very strongly about. But other than that, I think we've entered this area of personality politics that I think is a little bit dangerous. But I would say not as many voters as should be are voting based on policy.
Okay. Do you have any advice? And this will be my advice for me as well, because I struggle with this. Do you have any advice on how to have good conversations with politicians? Ezra Klein, who's a commentator at the New York Times, recently had this great description of podcasts with politicians and talking about the buffering face, which is the face when they get a question and they're trying to consider the best possible way to answer it to avoid getting themselves in trouble. And I've struggled with this as well when I've interviewed politicians and in getting authentic and answers that aren't part of that kind of buffering experience where they're trying to give you the safest but clearest answer.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I think podcasts are a good venue. You have to understand politicians are always on, right? They always have this guard up simply just because we live in this world where it's a 24/7 media cycle. Things are constantly happening. But you also have to understand politicians are just normal people too, right? They really are average people. You run it, they still have to go grocery shopping, they still gotta drive their car, and they still do normal stuff. I think people often put them in this weird category, some on a pedestal, or some that they're in this weird supernatural category because they're a politician. But really, they're just a normal person. I'm sure a lot of people listening to this do, but I run into some of our electeds all the time, just out and about around town. They're wearing sweatpants. They got to go to the store. So I think I would say you got to approach them. Obviously, you have to respect the office that they hold, but they're just a normal person. I would say approach them just as a normal person too.
Okay. What do you think we can do societally, and then maybe specifically here in Fresno, to move away from this culture of checkism? This is a term that was created by this economist named Noah Smith, where governments and politicians reward themselves with a claim for just spending the money. I think there is a culture of if it's the bigger the check, the larger the impact, but we're not necessarily following that process all the way through to look at results. Do you think that's something that we can change as a culture, or is that kind of just embedded in government?
No, I think that comes with working with organizations that are going to measure outcomes and try to get to those objectives. But certainly, I think part of that is because a politician's career is finite, right? So they are really just focused on getting the media attention, getting the headline oftentimes, rather than in 30 years measuring the outcomes of the program. They may not. Likely probably won't be elected anymore. They may not even be around anymore. So I think that's where, you see a lot of that driven from. Here in Fresno, I think it really comes with when we're passing these policies, when the city council is deliberating on something, ensuring that maybe there's if it's something that we're not sure is going to last, ensuring that there are some measurable outcomes that the city can go back and then explain to constituents and say, okay, here's what how we spent that money, here's what it went to. Now we have five parks. Now we have three new police officers. I'm just throwing out random examples, but I think being able to communicate what the tangible effects were of a certain initiative or government spending, I think is really important to be able to develop that trust with constituents and with voters.
Do you think political polarization is a bad thing generally? I've heard counters to this that it's iron sharpens iron. If you have strong points of view on either side, that's going to lead to, some kind of ideal middle ground of finding space between those extremes? Or do you think it just results in mostly stasis?
I think it's good to have different opinions when debating an issue. I think political polarization, as it is, I guess if you're defining political polarization as having different viewpoints, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think if you're defining political polarization as personally attacking and believing that your opponent is an enemy to your country or whatever it may be, I think that's a very bad thing. I think that's a dangerous thing. And I think we need to work to try to eliminate that zero-sum mentality that exists.
You've been doing a lot of work at the Maddie Institute around ag policy. What are some of the changes we should expect to see in ag policy over the next 10 to 20 years? Is it going to be a lot of climate change focus or energy policy, or what are the areas of where we'll see the most change in this domain?
Yeah, this is an area we've been working pretty heavily in. I would say, number one, we just reached 10 years of SGMA, so the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, which basically, to sum it up in a nutshell, places requirements and regulations to be able to recharge our groundwater aquifer basins to avoid subsidence. So that's where, we've seen a lot of change there. We've seen how there's a big shift in how agricultural producers, farmers are putting water into the ground to be able to recharge the aquifers when they've been historically overdrafted. I do think there are going to be a lot of climate challenges that face farmers over the next several years. Certainly, we're already seeing that play out in real time, I would say. I think labor and supply chain issues are also underrated as well. As labor changes over time, there have been a lot of labor challenges and labor shortages for farmers to be able to harvest their crops. And so I think that's a critical thing that we need to address. And I think also supply chain. We really saw this emerge out of COVID when people are not able to ship products or when products are just being held at the port for months and months. Food goes bad at some point. You can only preserve it for so long. So not only does that impact farmers locally, but all of the ancillary industries in our local economy that are tied to ag directly or indirectly feel the brunt of that as well. So I think those are all important issues.
How do you think about the divide between ag interests and environmental interests? Speaking of polarization, this is a kind of a huge division. And I think both of those perspectives have a voice and importance at the table, but oftentimes they don't even want to sit at the table, or we just result in just results in litigation and endless court battles over a pond somewhere. And it seems to me that in order to move forward, both of these respective groups need to work together. What do you think are some approaches that can be taken to bridge those gaps and create a common conversation?
Yeah, that's a great question. We, the Maddie Institute, in partnership with the California Water Institute, just held our second annual Ag Summit. And this was really one of the key focuses. The theme of the summit was exploring the coexistence of water users in California. And so we brought people from the environmental community, we brought farmers, we brought water officials, we brought other folks into the room together to be able to discuss some of these important issues. And I think the conversations happen more often than not. There's this idea that environmentalists and farmers are constantly at each other's throats. You talk to most farmers, they want to protect the environment. They're trying to produce food. Having a bad environment, having a polluted water supply, having a place where they can't grow their crops is bad for them, not only from a business perspective, but from a livelihood perspective. So I think you talk to a lot of small farmers. They don't like the idea of being considered anti-environmentalists. I think also too, it just comes down to education and facilitation on these issues and facilitating these discussions, trying to make people understand that we have to produce our own food. We have to be able to be self-reliant. And the San Joaquin Valley is a huge part of that. But also I think too, just trying to bring those folks together and have a dialogue on these issues goes a long way. Because then I think they start to build a relationship, build those open channels of communication, and it really breaks down those barriers from always having to go directly to litigation.
Yeah. And I think part of the problem is when we monolithically define different groups. Resnick at Wonderful Farms is a farmer, and so is Mas Masumoto. And they couldn't be more different, but they're all farmers and they're all trying to grow fruit or grow whatever they're growing and want to have a sustainable environment for that. And I think it can get complicated, and certainly there's bad actors, but I think overall, most of the people I talk to are pretty well-intentioned. All right, let's jump to some Fresno State questions before we wrap up here. This one could get us both in trouble, but I'm going to go with it anyway because it's fun. A large number of Division I schools lose money on sports. I think the average was somewhere in the range of 20 to 40 million. And then only less than 10% of schools break even in terms of their revenue on sports and athletics. So I guess my question for you is, do you think that's a problem universally, and how should Fresno State think about the costs of its athletics program?
Man, yeah, you're getting me in trouble here, Jordan. But I
Yeah.
think, no, I'm
Because
someone
we
who
need sports.
believes.
I'm not trying to say let's cancel football. What I'm trying to say is, how do we think about cost benefit when it comes to sports? Because I think for a lot of people, sports are sacrosanct, and I understand that. It's an important part of our culture. But also thinking about the best ways to spend money, how to avoid cost overruns, all those things are important when you're running an institution.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's a great point. Certainly, I think one of the big things that I look at is sports are really, we have an incredible thing here in the San Joaquin Valley where we have developed a lot of talented athletes and a lot of them stay here in the region. And I think it's great to have robust athletics programs, not just at Fresno State, but all the Valley universities, certainly the Maddie Institute works with, just because I think it's also a marketing opportunity and it's a gateway for the Valley into other parts of the country. And so it puts us on the map. People love to watch sports. People know where Fresno is because of Fresno State football. They know where Fresno is because of its athletics programs. And so that can be a lot of benefit to our academic programs, to trying to develop other opportunities to build bridges with other academic institutions. And when we're working on a research initiative together or something like that. So I'm someone who tends to view absolutely should we have we shouldn't have irresponsible spending on sports. We definitely need to make sure that our dollars are being spent wisely, and most of all, are benefiting the student athletes too. The student athletes are a critical component of this conversation, and I think that there's more of a shift that's going towards the student athletes and being more pro student athlete, especially with all being developed and all of that stuff. But I do think. Yeah, I do think that there is an ROI on sports, especially at Fresno State. It really puts us on the map and it's a gateway throughout the rest of the country too.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. More people are familiar with Fresno State than they are Cal State Bakersfield for that exact reason. Does Cal State Bakersfield have a football team? I don't even know if they have a football team.
I
Maybe.
believe they might. I believe they might, but
Okay,
hey, you
yeah.
know,
But that kind of that illustrates the point, right?
we still
Yeah.
love the Road Runner. We still love the Road Runners though. They're great.
Yeah. In terms of academics at Fresno State, what for you are one of Fresno State's strengths in this domain? And what's an area where you think they could grow? I know there's a lot of programs that are heavily impacted at Fresno State where they need a lot more seats for the amount of butts that they want to fit in them and they can't right now. What's your kind of like overall picture on where Fresno State is academically?
Yeah, I think academically Fresno State is severely underrated. It's one of the it just you know held national rankings in the U.S. News and World Report for you know its social mobility ranking. I think that Fresno State has some of the premier academic scholars in their field on campus, and I think a lot of people don't realize that, whether it be in the engineering school or the political science department. My colleague Lisa Bryant was just named a Carnegie Fellow. And there are a lot of prestigious folks who work at Fresno State in all of the schools. So I think Fresno State is severely underrated academically. But I think how you put it was perfect. One of the challenges and one of the growth opportunities for Fresno State academically is that capacity issue. And so I think having more spots for nursing students, having more spots for some of these severely impacted fields where they become very competitive because there just simply aren't enough spots. I mean, I know folks who have, there's a student in their family who's trying to get into the nursing school. They have a 3.9 GPA, They didn't get in because all of the current students are 4.0 students. And so we may think that's a good thing because we want our nurses certainly to be very smart when they're working on our health issues. But I think that's something that's a big challenge. And so I hope that the state considers higher education moving forward as a really important component of its funding priorities. Because simply, especially in the Valley, UC Merced, Fresno State, Cal State Bakersfield and Stanislaus State, they all play a critical role, not just in education, but in the local economy. I think Fresno State puts out like $1 billion of economic output in Fresno's economy every year. So we really have to take these things into consideration. It's not just an education question, it's also an economic and opportunity question as well.
Absolutely. I want to talk about the Maddie Institute now, and I want to ask you just to start about the different programming options for students. And then if you could share one success story that you've had in your time there with a student who you were able to channel into a great program or channel into a great career or have a really amazing experience working legislatively. I just want you to share maybe one or two success stories as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think first of all, it's such an honor to be working in at the Maddie Institute. I was a Maddie legislative intern starting out in my undergraduate career in college, and so it's so cool to be back here and have this opportunity now at the helm of the organization. I think in terms of students, so many amazing students. We have over 500 alumni. Actually, we're approaching 600 alumni that have gone through our legislative internship program in the past 25 years of existence. And a lot of that credit goes to my predecessor, Mark Kepler, who was at the helm for almost 20 years of the Maddie Institute. So he really built up the program to what it is today. But recently, in my short tenure at the Maddie Institute, I would say one of our students just recently got into the Panetta Institute program, which is a very prestigious program where you spend a semester in Washington, D.C., interning on the Hill. And she actually was not only just a Maddie intern, she worked for us as well, and then was able to apply and get that. And so I'm not saying it's all because of the Maddie Institute, because we certainly have had a lot of amazing students who can do incredible things on their own. But I think it just speaks to the caliber of the program. It really helps prepare students to thrive in any career field. It's a really incredible program. I'm really excited for that student. We have a lot of other students who've gone on to do amazing things in their careers. We have students who now work for local elected officials, assembly members, state senators. We have alumni who now have gone on to operate their own companies, run nonprofits. So it's a really awesome experience just to see where they all land.
Yeah, I think it seems like a great organization in terms of talent allocation because we all know the talents there. It's about funneling that talent to the right places. And that's an overall struggle that I found in the Central Valley. And I'm sure you can attest to this, that you have all these talented people, but they've been misallocated in terms of where they are and what their best abilities are and their strengths and putting them in the position where they can thrive, but also help our region to grow successfully as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Before we close with book recommendations, what are some of the other things that the Maddie Institute does beyond the specific work with students? You've had a number of events recently. Can you share some of the broader programming that you have, and we'll go from there to books.
Yeah, sure. I think so. We do a lot of different things. We really have three core tenets. Number one is training the next generation of Valley leaders, developing them to be bipartisan problem solvers through our legislative internship program. Secondly, it's increasing citizen participation. We talked a lot about during our discussion earlier, Jordan, was how do we bridge that gap between people and their elected officials and government representatives? How do we get them more engaged in the democratic process? I'm participating in a number of forums and debates locally. I'm moderating a couple debates. We're helping sponsor a debate in Modesto between former Assemblymember Adam Gray and Congressman John Duarte, one of the most probably watched races in the country right now.
God, can we stop with the commercials? That's just, I don't watch a lot of TV. Whenever there's some good sports event on, I'll watch it. And I feel like it's every commercial break, I get to see those two guys again.
Yeah, there people probably know them. They're probably the most famous people in the Valley right now. Yeah, so that's going to be exciting. It's a live audience, so we're going to have, I think, probably 300 people be able to attend. So that stuff is really cool. I love doing that stuff. And then finally, we do nonpartisan public policy analysis. So we have our MATI report program where I invite guests on, elected officials, policy experts to give their take on what the issues are and what's going on. Very similar to your show, Jordan. I ask similar questions to folks. So it's interesting now to be on the other side of that,
Yeah.
receiving the questions. But and then we also have a podcast that does similar things as well. And I think, and then we also have different programs like our Central Valley Legislative Roundtable, where we bring elected official staff together and we talk about a different issue that's impacting the San Joaquin Valley. And that's a really cool program just because it really shows that people are interested in solutions. I think we often think, oh my gosh, this person's a Democrat or they're a Republican, they're not representing me. But the legislative staff behind the scenes works so incredibly hard to be able to represent all constituents and work on these issues. And so it's cool to see everyone come together to talk about things like the Madera hospital closure or the nursing shortage or childcare cost issues. We're going to be in Modesto in a couple of weeks talking about that with legislative staff. So I think that is a cool work that we do behind the scenes that people just don't get to see.
Okay. We always close with the same pl in we oh man, I'm so tired. We always close in the same place with book recommendations. Blake, what are a few books you'd recommend to the audience?
Yeah, I would say one of my favorite authors is Doris Kearns Goodwin. She's a presidential historian. She came to Fresno a while back, and I had the opportunity to hear her speak about the current state of the presidency and all of that. So I thought that was really neat. But I love two of her books that I'll recommend to the audience. One is Team of Rivals. It's about Abraham Lincoln and his life, and so how he surrounded himself with different political rivals. And I try to adopt that philosophy myself. I like surrounding myself with contrarian voices because I think it makes us a little bit better. And so I also really Leadership in Turbulent Times. And that one profiles several different presidents. It profiles LBJ, it profiles FDR, Teddy Roosevelt, and also Abraham Lincoln. And so it just talks about their different leadership trials and how they got to where they were and how they were able to overcome obstacles. So both really great books, very well written. Would definitely recommend them to the audience.
Okay, fantastic. If people want to learn more about the MATI Institute, and if they're not Fresno State students, is there ways for them to get involved as well?
Yeah, absolutely. We are very Fresno centric, which is something we're trying to actively change, but we also serve the campuses of CSU Bakersfield and Stanislaus and also UC Merced. So we welcome those students to apply, but you can go on our website, mattiinstitute.com, which we're currently working on updating. You may go on there and it's a little archaic at the moment. It hasn't been updated in a while, but we will hopefully by the end of the year have a much more sleek, modern looking website. But you can go on mattiinstitute.com or reach out to our office, give us a call at 278-1133. And I'm always happy to talk to folks or if a listener heard something I said and completely disagrees and wants to yell at me, I'm happy to talk to him as
That
well.
never
So
happens. What are you talking about? Oh, it's just
I'm very open. So
Well,
very open.
Blake, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and the work that you're doing at the MATI Institute.
Great. Thank you so much, Jordan. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.